I'm Gary Dopp. I'm here today with a friend, Jack Gilroy, who has been active on a lot of issues throughout the decades previous to now, and has been writing as at the same time has been author of a number of books and also of a play produced widely across the United States, a play called The Predator. We're here to talk about drones. Jack, would you like to introduce yourself a little more biography of where you've been in your life?
Well, surely. For many people watching this, I'm sure they were either in the military, if they were around my age, or they have friends who are in the military. And of course, today only 1% of the United States is involved in the military. So I took an oath to defend my country, to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And that was way back in the 1950s. And I have honorable discharges from both the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Army. So I'm double trouble there. I've got to defend it right down the line. And I once believed that the enemies were outside of this country. I live the what I call the American myth, right? That the enemies are outside of the United States. But I have learned over the years that the enemies are within. They're right here. In the United States.
Now, what do you mean by that, Jack?
Well, I mean, for example, with our recent situation with conflict in the Middle East. I say recent for the last 23 years. This has been a war going on now for 23 years. It's not just the recent bombing in Syria. But there were no Syrians or Libyans or Iraqis or Afghanistans, right, that came to this country. And attacked us. 9/11 was put up as an attack by Iraq, and we know that that's been proven to be another one of the lies. And now today, we are getting ourselves even in the deeper situation by creating terrorists, by killing people in Middle Eastern countries with drones. And drones have kind of an interesting term because people think of them as something someday Amazon is going to deliver something to their doorstep. We're talking about killer drones, attack drones, drones that kill people.
So drones that are used to film movies or deliver products, or you're not worried about those so much?
No, I think there are worries for the FAA, the Federal Aeronautics Administration, about, you know, the number of drones in the air and the safety of American aircraft. That's definitely, you know, an important feature. But we're talking about attack drones. The very name itself, you pretty well know what we're up to. And we're up to quite a bit in a lot of countries. We have used drones against the people of Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, even the Philippines. Drones have been used. So what are these drones? Well, the one that you mentioned, my play, The Predator, someone said you should probably call it The Reaper because The Predator was the first major attack drone. It was once used as a reconnaissance type of drone. But back in 2001, it was the Predator that was first used to kill people in Afghanistan. Since then, instead of 100 or so drones, we have over 8,000 Predator drones. And the number of Reaper drones, the newest drone, which is bigger, carries a bigger payload, they are increasing substantially, too, in numbers.
Now, these are unpiloted aircraft.
Right.
They're drones. Not having a pilot aboard, how do they get to their target?
Well, the targets, for example, in the Middle East are controlled by so-called pilots in the United States. And the pilots sit behind a console, a computer-like affair, with a crew, a couple of individuals with them to look at, or her, there are women pilots as well, to look at what is on the screen. And if the information is that they believe that they are tracking bad guys, very often through cell phones, by the way, or chips that are used, homing chips that the CIA is able to place in certain areas around countries where we feel there is enemy, then the decision to fire is made. But what we have in the United States is what we call signature killings, where the president and sometimes people say it's a gang of eight individuals in Washington, D.C., they decide, you know, what the military is going to do, who they are going to kill on any particular day. In fact, I understand it's each Tuesday that the president and several of his advisors get together with information, so-called intelligence, that they have received as to who the people are that they're going to kill that particular day or week.
Well, I can imagine that there are lots of sort of prospective targets, people that have been identified as perhaps having some malevolent intents toward the United States. How do they find these people, and how do they know that the people they are looking at in these in these machines are actually the people they're attempting to kill?
Well, a lot of the information is similar to the information that came for the capture of people to send to Guantanamo. Remember, the truth of that was that individuals, bounty hunters, were paid huge sums by the CIA. So they would then target individuals maybe who were neighbors or people they knew who were of a different political view that they had. They became the enemy, and the CIA captured them, and off they went to Guantanamo. Well, what we have similar to that is, where is the information coming from? And it's so, you know, there is no transparency here. We really don't know. Even the major journalists in the United States don't know. The Stanford Law School and the New York City NYU Law School came together to investigate intensely for several years. And they came up with some very shocking material. But they found out that to get the real reason or the real intelligence as to why these people are enemies, that's not easy to find. You can't get that out of the administration, whether it's the CIA or the U.S. government itself.
So there's a lot that observers can't really critique from. We don't have a lot of information that's specific. We don't know very many of the people in Yemen, for example, or in Pakistan, and in that region to the north, the Waziristan, and so on.
Right.
As the process unfolds with this targeting of people, how accurate have they been? I've heard a lot of claims from the government that they are very precise. They've eliminated the people they needed to, and of course the government would say, you know, we have some alternatives here. Mm-hmm. We can send men to try to defend ourselves, or we can use these drones, which means that we don't have to put any of American soldiers in harm's way. We can do this pretty surgically. What do you say to that?
Well, the long study we just mentioned by Stanford and New York University law schools, they used a lot of information from the Bureau of Independent Journalists operating out of London. And they said of all the groups that they have checked out, they seem to be the most authentic. And they are willing to admit that, yes, there have been some so-called bad guys that have been eliminated. But of all the attacks made, they say only 2% have actually eliminated individuals who were definitely considered to be serious bad guys. Whether they were an actual threat, imminent threat to the United States, we don't know that either. But who were the other 98%? Well, check out some of the statistics of individuals who went and talked to parents, for example, about picking up pieces of their children. You know, we don't like to talk about this in the United States. We don't even show Americans coming back to the United States. Remember that you used to show them with flags on the coffins? We pretend that that doesn't exist. We don't see this sort of thing in the daily newspapers. But individuals in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, they have seen it. In particulars, there was a case, for example, just 2 years ago, in the northern part of Pakistan, in one of the federal autonomous areas, sort of areas like, well, the closest analogy might be American Indian reservations, where they have tribal individuals and chiefs. They have their own yurgas, the little get-togethers where they come to decide what should be done in their community. And the CIA decided that there was a meeting taking place down at a bus depot in North Waziristan, and they had a Reaper drone strike that area with Hellfire missiles, which, you know, keep the stock of Lockheed Martin right up there. because Lockheed Martin is making the missiles, General Atomics making the drone itself. It's a big industry and all the subsidiary industries out there. But it hit, anyway, it hit that bus station. 42 people were killed. And they said first that, yes, they had struck some of the leaders, some of the real serious people. But gradually the information came out from journalists, from individuals in the town, from some of the tribal leaders themselves who survived, and said we're having a meeting to try to decide various issues that came up. And yet all of our people, their bodies are splattered all over the place. So that's just one example. We have hit weddings where we assume where the CIA or the United States government, the Pentagon, decides that there are individuals who are suspect and people are killed by the score. Weddings, a mosque was hit. First it was said that it was a town meeting house, and they said no, it was a house, and then they found out it was actually a mosque. Where that many individuals who have spent time, Americans and Europeans and others, that have spent time in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, say that probably drones are the best recruiting tool for terrorists, probably the very best recruiting tool. Imagine what would happen here in our community in upstate New York if some foreign nation began to attack certain places where meetings, town meetings or whatever were taking place, weddings or church groups, and children and women and all were killed. Imagine what the feeling would be here. You know, that's not happening. Yeah, but it could happen if we continue this kind of action.
I think one of the findings of the group from Stanford University mm-hmm. and NYU who were studying the effects of the drones and the impact on the population of mm-hmm. of those areas in Pakistan, one of the things they talk about is a follow-up strike. That is, that after a drone has been launched, mm-hmm. Right. very soon another one would be launched in the same place. Tell us about what
sure,
that does.
Sure. Yeah, they recruit very much from young people who have become very good at PlayStation and various kinds of video games, etc. This is true. They recruit them in there.
So to be the pilots of the drones.
And these young recruiters. When they become trained, usually as assistants to the pilots, some of them have reported what they call all of this. Yes, when an individual tries to get away, they have terms for those individuals. First, if the area is hit, a blob comes right out on the screen. It's usually a reddish color, and that's called bug splat. That's bug splat. And the individuals who are getting away, I believe the term is called the squirmish. They have a phrase for it, though, or the people somehow or another escaping. And so what they do, they wait. The drone waits. The drone is overhead, right? It's there with that humming sound, waiting for something else to happen. And the photographs are going back to either Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, Hancock Air Force Base up at Syracuse, New York, Langley Field, maybe, in Washington, D.C., whoever is running that, CIA would be doing Langley Field. They then wait for the first responders, the people who want to come in to help their relatives, friends, neighbors, just as we would here in the United States. And they call it double tap. That's called double tap. So they hit again. They fire more. The Reaper can hold a number of Hellfire missiles. And they fire more at that group who are the first responders.
So what does that do then for people who have been badly injured in one of these things and one of these attacks?
Right. Well, those badly injured obviously are probably killed, and then the individuals who come to their assistance to try to drag them out, they are killed as well.
So that keeps them from basically even daring to go back sometimes, doesn't it?
Right. They wonder, they're afraid to talk about all of this because they know that there are individuals within the community that are being paid by the United States, by the CIA and other operatives to try to identify individuals who might be a danger to the U.S. And again, only 2% according to the Bureau for Independent Journalism, and according to the Stanford University, New York University, only 2% are actual targets. So we are murdering scores of people.
You know, some would say in the military and in the intelligence services that war is a nasty business, mm-hmm. and that it always will be a nasty business. But they may say also, you know, this is a fairly dirty business, but it's either we do something to interfere with those who are planning attacks on the United States, mm-hmm. or we don't, and we allow ourselves to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And even though this is a nasty thing and it recruits people for opposition, it's all we can do because we have to do something. Mm-hmm. What would you say to that?
Well, I think there are various somethings that could be done. I think, number one, if you're talking about individuals who are not good people, we have a lot in this country, but if you really wanted to target those people, then we really need to work through the United Nations and international police force. There is such a thing as international law. And we need to forget about the fact that we are the superpower and that we decide who is going to live and who is going to die. International police force could very well have gone in and gotten the Taliban. There were not that many Taliban in Afghanistan. But instead, we had a bomb wreck, you know, havoc over all of Afghanistan. It's our longest war ever, still going on. Iraq, if they really wanted to get individuals like Saddam Hussein, there were ways within Iraq that he could have been captured long before he was. But the American thing is to use violence. And the curious thing is it hasn't worked. It just simply has not worked. And yet we're addicted to it. And by even our addiction, we seem to suffer from amnesia. We forget that it didn't work, you know, in Vietnam, right? 3 million people, you know, why individuals would brag about being in Vietnam. 3 million people, you know, we killed in Vietnam and left a scourge of Agent Orange, not just among the number of Americans, which is small compared to Agent Orange that young children and families and all still suffer from in Vietnam. And you could go on. The United States, since the end of World War II, has invaded and attacked over 40 countries. We have troops in 1,800 bases, imagine that, in over 120 countries around the world.
You know, there's such a popular support for mm-hmm. some of that, isn't there? I mean, it's not just the politicians, but mm-hmm. any time a politician mm-hmm. says, you know, we could take a less violent route, mm-hmm. that politician is targeted for attack,
being soft,
isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for being soft. That's part of the education, I think, that we have given to our young children in schools. I would ask them to go to some of the websites that are out there to try to find ways that their kids could get readings and videos and books to turn them away from that mindset. It's a major job because teachers themselves. I was a high school teacher for many, many years. And teachers themselves are the victims of this sort of indoctrination in the myth of American goodness. We're a good country, but we have gone astray. We have gone astray many times throughout our history.
But it's ironic, isn't it, that, say, in Afghanistan, to take one example, mm-hmm. for many years we were pumping American money into building up the Taliban mm-hmm. to defeat the Russians who had right. interfered in Afghanistan True. A couple of decades ago.
True.
And then that very same force, we turn the tables and fight against them. Mm-hmm. In yeah. Libya, mm-hmm. for so long, we had fought against Muammar Gaddafi, but mm-hmm. then we tried to develop a rapprochement with him. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we sort of turned on him at the same time. Mm-hmm. So it seems like the fortunes of a particular country change very frequently, and our foreign policy doesn't seem always to be consistent, does it?
Yeah, our foreign policy doesn't. I think we could start thinking about bombing people with food and with medicine. With frames for schools, building schools, even with cell phones for better communication, for that matter. There are many ways that we could become popular with people in the Middle East instead of using Hellfire missiles. in bombs. You know, there are ways. Before long, I think they're going to look, if we did that, they would look upon the United States with a much better feeling that the United States really was interested. And it would be such a small part of the $2 trillion that we've spent on wars in the last 23 years in the Middle East. It would be into the millions or maybe billions to give that food. I was a young soldier in 1955 in occupied Austria. And looking across the Danube, I could see on the east side, on the Russian side, it was all rubble. It was destroyed, of course, by all the bombings that took place in Vienna. But then you just look over a bit to the rest of the international zone, which was like Berlin, had an international zone, and in the other zones, and it was vigorous. It was really building up because the Americans and the Europeans decided, Western Europeans, they were going to rebuild. They were going to do things. And the attitude toward Americans was just so positive in Austria. They really loved the Americans. The Germans, liked what was going on as well. We had a Marshall Plan that made America, we forget that the Marshall Plan was to assist Europe build up again, but it helped make America rich too. We were shipping over even concrete for that matter, steel, wood, electrical appliances. All of that was giving work to Americans, right? And we were building up Europe. The Russians didn't get it, right? They didn't get it. And the people didn't trust the Russians. But in 1955, the Russians moved out, and Marshall Plan money and others went into the eastern part of Vienna and that whole area. Today, if you were to travel there, it's amazing. It's one of the great peaceful places on the earth. You don't see the shanty towns like you see in the United States. You don't see the poverty. It's a very progressive and wealthy area. The Middle East could be that. It's the cradle of civilization, and we're destroying it and continuing to destroy this very cradle of civilization.
There's a lot of contradictions, and it's very hard to know how to change the course in the middle, isn't it? We continue to build so many enemies, and how do we create connections to build trust? It's very hard to find trust in an environment like that.
Especially when you dig yourself in as deep as we're doing now. And again, with that amnesia problem, saying that the answer to the problem in Syria is more bombs, that's not going to be it. We've got to work with, my belief is, and I think not just my belief, but the belief of a lot of people who have followed United States policy for many years, understand that we have to work with the people in the communities. Instead of sending Hellfire missiles into some of these meetings in Pakistan or Afghanistan or whatever, if the CIA, we can't get rid of them, if they're doing anything, they should try to help these people improve their situation rather than feel that they are somehow terrorists.
Jack, with that, we're left with the question, where do we fit into this ourselves? And are we willing to engage and to be imaginative and to support people who have ideas about the ways in which we can change our policy, the ways in which we can find mechanisms to build people's lives rather than to tear them apart? So I guess a lot of the challenge rests with you and I and with all the others who care about the future of our country and the future of the world in which we share a part.
Right. And you a man of the cloth, we're taping this in a Catholic church, a hall in a Catholic church. Christianity, is on another crusade. And what are they saying about it? Not an awful lot. We haven't said much about it in the last 23 years. How many times, and I've traveled around to both Protestant and Catholic churches, and it is extremely rare where the pastor, the priest or the minister will speak openly in opposition to violence. And yet they claim to be Christian. And it seems to me that this is a mask. It's sort of a cover that Christian pastors and other Christian leaders have been using in order to be part of the national system. I think the illustration in Vienna in 1939, when Anschluss took place, of Catholic cardinals giving the Sieg Heil to the marching Nazis as they came in, is a pretty good example of how church will very often support the state no matter what they do. And so today we have a situation where, for example, some of us as Catholics went to speak to the Bishop of Syracuse. Bishop Cunningham, it took him 2.5 years before he said that he would speak to us. He said first he didn't know an awful lot about drones. So we sent him just about everything we had on drones. Finally, he allowed 5 of us to go and to speak to him. And we asked him, instead of lecturing to him, we asked him what he really thought about the morality of drones, since they were being fired only 5 miles away, which wouldn't be too long of a walk for him, the walk up there, or even the drive up to Hancock drone base. And he thought for a few seconds, and he said, that's a complicated question. He said, I really haven't made up my mind yet. To us, it's not complicated. When you assassinate people, that is not what we believe Christianity is about. We believe the basic concept is love, right? That you're concerned with loving people, not killing people. And it goes back to Judaism as well, that, right, thou shalt not kill. But yet, you know, we have accommodated just about every militaristic group that has come in, especially with Christians for the last 1,700 years, since the time of Constantine. We have done that. And I see little change in that. He also said, by the way, he said, you also remember, he said, if you're Catholics, and most of us were at this meeting, he said, if you're Catholics, there are a lot of Catholics that work at Hancock, at the drone base. So he's bringing up the same thing that the politicians are bringing up. Senator Schumer, you know, who is very much in New York State, is very much in support of drones because they will create jobs. And Senator Gillibrand is pretty much in the same boat. So when you have people looking to their religious and political leaders and not being concerned with murder, that many of the leaders are war criminals, then, you know, it doesn't make an awful lot of sense to me, but it makes sense to people because that's the way it was and that's the way it's probably always going to be. It doesn't have to be.
Could you tell us a little bit about your service record and where that took you in the military?
For most of the time, I was a basic infantryman. I was I was a teenager, and had been in the Naval Reserve and asked for a discharge after a year and a half to get into. I joined when I was 17 to get into the U.S. Army, and I was sent to Austria. And in Austria, it was the 19.
Would that have been?
That was 1955, and at that time, the Cold War was getting hot, more or less. Things were beginning to look pretty grim, but Russia surprised everybody and said that they were going to move out of Austria. And here we had been taught that the Russians were the most evil of all people. Even though as kids we were kind of confused because first it was the Germans and then the Japanese and then the Chinese and then the Russians and then the Vietnamese and not the North Korea, the South Koreans, but the North Koreans, etc. You know the story. But I was firmly in belief that these people were not good individuals. And we had a colonel, 30 of us were taken out of the mountains where we had a perimeter of defense against possible invasion by the Russians. I was taken down it became part of a 30-man team that would change guard with the Russians, and we're very proud of that. But also, we wanted to look as mean and bad as possible, and we went and had cleats put on our boots so they would know us when they heard us coming across the Schönbrunn Palace, stomping away, and we had our hair shaved, right, totally shaved. And our colonel, we had a bird colonel, which is, you know, pretty amazing to get it's usually a sergeant to be your drill instructor, bird colonel. And he told us that we would be looking directly at our opponent, these Russian soldiers, and they were to look them in the eye and think of them with words in your mind that I couldn't mention right here on television. We were to think the worst of these people. And so we came up very close, probably 5 or 6 feet away, because there was a manhole cover right between us. And when our colonel saluted at that manhole cover, that was the end of Russian and American occupation, the formal end. The CIA, Dulles was up in the stands right behind us. The Russian bands played, the American bands played. It was big stuff. But when I looked across at my counterpart, I saw a young man with, he had blonde hair coming down over his ears, and he had this sort of sad look on his face. He didn't look like the devilish character that I was told that he looked at. And that was the beginning of my epiphany, the beginning of the realization that I was living with a lie, you know, to challenge these people as being evil and as bad people. And ever since that time, I've been trying to get across the point that we can get along with other people without using violence. And I firmly believe that today.
Well, you've been part of an organization, and your own life has been dedicated to working at peaceful interventions. You've been working more lately with a group that has had a presence at Hancock Air Force Base in Syracuse, where one of the drone centers is located, the pilot centers.
That's right.
Tell us about what has happened to you in those experiences of protest.
Sure. Right. I was arrested on two occasions up there at Hancock, and on the first time they lost my papers, so I went free. The second time I was involved on April 28th of 2013. I joined a group of people who were in funeral clothing. I didn't happen to have funeral clothing, black garb at the time, but I joined them, and we walked down to Hancock to the base in a very solemn procession, a very solemn procession to remember those who have been killed by the United States, and specifically out of Hancock. And we lied down on the entranceway to the drone base. It was a Sunday afternoon, hardly anyone around, but we were all arrested, and instead of arresting people and saying you're going to go to jail for a couple days or a week, as what has happened in the past, they upped the ante. So in a few days from now, I will be before a judge who told me that I am going to go to prison for a year. And it was curious that he told me that, because the trial was still on. It doesn't seem like a judge should make a judgment, but he did. He refused to allow an expert that I had, that I took in from Notre Dame University, a professor of law, Mary Ellen O'Connell, and she was going to testify to the illegality of drones, the illegality. He refused to allow her to testify. So I feel that he and the whole system are really enablers. They're part of the system. They enable individuals such as the President of the United States, the CIA, and the NSA, the National Security Agency, all of these groups, to operate without any particular problem. But if he read the Constitution, he would find that he is liable. That and if he looked at some of the treaties that we have made with the United States, they specifically point out that all justices and jurors, or all justices from the town level right up to the Supreme Court, are bound by treaties of the United States. And one of the treaties is that, you know, Nuremberg itself, that we will, if we see that the United States or our country, wherever we are, that we are doing illegal acts, that we must, as people, take action against it. Our Constitution, Article 6, Section 2, states that the Constitution, that all treaties of the United States must be obligated. This is the supreme law of the land. And yet we know we broke treaties with the Indians, right?
There was hardly a one that was ever kept to its fullest.
And we're following the same sort of thing. We're breaking treaties now, the United Nations treaties, the Nuremberg, which was an obligation to us. All of these are being just spurned, pushed aside, so that the power of the United States can be asserted.
So it's a matter of convenience rather than consistency. And when citizens protest, they incur the wrath of those who want the right to the opportunity to exercise power and as they feel it's needed.
Right. We find it pretty curious that that we're considered to be criminals. I was convicted actually already of that. My trial, as I said, my sentence will be coming up. That I was convicted by simply asserting First Amendment rights by walking in a procession, totally nonviolent. We take a nonviolent oath before we do anything like this. By lying down for 30 seconds, we're obstructing government administration, which means 1 year in prison. I have a gut feeling that this judge is not going to give that 1 year, but I may be surprised, in just a few days when I go before him. I think that he knows that he's wrong. I have an idea that maybe we are making an impact. There are certain things going on around the country to indicate that maybe we're getting the word out about drones. And maybe he's learning. You know, there's a possibility that he is learning.
And what is it, to kind of summarize, that people might want to take with them? Can you say what are the treaties or the laws that we are violating when we do operate drones as we have, as vehicles of assassination and of targeted killing of groups throughout the world?
Right. Now, before we even go in the law, I would say that many of us operate on morality. We like to think that Americans are basically a good, decent, moral nation. But because the truth has been held back from them, and because they misunderstand, because there has been no transparency in many things that go on, and because media loves it, you know, not just Fox, but all of the media just love this particular action. You know, it generates advertising. So they have to start to be, I think people have to start to think about the moral consequences. And if they look at law, again, go to Article 6, Section 2, and reread it. Reread what the Constitution has to say. Look at Nuremberg, the Nuremberg Principles, and see how we were supposed to follow that again and not attack sovereign nations. This was absolutely forbidden.
So that would be the point at which international law is clearly violated, when without a necessary provocation, right, we impose our power on that of other sovereign nations without their permission.
That's right. We have signed on to the Human Rights Declaration, right, of December 10th, 1946, I believe. And that'll be coming up in just a few months. But look that over and find out, you know, have we really stayed with that Declaration of Human Rights? It's a good document. And if we did, if we begin to look more, not at what Lockheed Martin or Boeing or whatever is going to produce, because we are the biggest exporter. That's our biggest export is weapons around the world. That's a disgrace. It's shameful, absolutely shameful. But we were the people who used to make good things, made in America. We're so proud of it. And yet now the only thing that really seems to be super effective, wanted throughout the world, or one of the only things, are weapons. And now, of course, it's drones. And drones are now in the 82 countries. To think that we are going to, I'm talking about armed drones too, but to think that we are going to be somehow safe by showing the world what to do with drones, by killing people indiscriminately, then I think we're in for some bad news in the future.
Well, Jack, thank you. I appreciate so much your time and your witness and your energy in seeking another way.
Thank you.
And peace to all who are watching us and who are with you in this struggle.
Thank you.